Warning, the Catholic Man Show contains high levels of manliness. If you think you may be too weak to withstand the manliness represented in the following program, please do yourself a favor and stop listening now. If you choose to continue in spite of this warning, if at any time you feel yourself overcome by the manliness, stop immediately and consult your closest medical professional. And now, for the not so fair, faint, or frilly, we present The Catholic Man Show.
And welcome to The Catholic Man Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. I'm Adam Minahan, sitting here with my co-host, David Niles. And Dave, we do three things every episode on The Catholic Man Show. And you know what? We're going to scratch all of it.
not all of it.
Yeah, you're right. Not the first part. But we typically open, review, and enjoy a man beverage. We highlight a man gear, and we have a man topic. However, this is a special edition of The Catholic Man Show. Dave, you and I, when we started this journey of The Catholic Man Show, we started it almost, one of the reasons was is that we had whiskeys at the end of the night, and we talked about philosophy and theology and just man topics.
Right. Yeah.
And we desired to kind of learn more about whiskey and learn more about, you know, just the whiskey culture in general. And we found that a lot of men who listen to our show are on the same way. They feel the same way. They just don't know where to start. They don't know what to do, or maybe they're not familiar with whiskey. So, Dave, we decided to bring in a special guest, Mark Gillespie. Mark, thank you so much for hanging out with us this evening.
Thank you for having me, guys. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, Mark, you are in 2005... You started something that most people didn't even know what a podcast was at that time. Tell us a little bit about what you started in 2005.
Well, I started doing a Whiskey Cast. It's a weekly podcast on whiskeys. We call it cask strength conversation around here, where we talk a little bit about whiskey news, the new whiskeys that are out, stories that affect whiskey consumers, and then sit down and talk with experts in the field, either writers, distillers, blenders, or somebody who's got an interesting story to tell. The reason I wanted to do this was to tell great stories and let people tell their own stories and collect some of those stories from old timers while we still had a chance to get them on the air and get their stories told. And it's just sort of snowballed into a full-time career now.
That's what I love about some of the whiskey stories that I listen to on Whiskey Cast is a lot of it originates from a family tradition that started, or you know, the monks coming in together and figuring something out. The stories of whiskey is just awesome.
I agree. Yeah, they all involve like just back when men were men doing things awesomely, you know. And they're just always, they're also romantic in the, you know, most literal sense of the word.
Can I stop you guys for just a second here?
Sure.
Because I'm sure that there are probably a few women who are listening to this show. And I just want to point out that we're seeing a lot more women drinking whiskey these days. All of my daughters drink whiskey, for instance. My wife drinks whiskey. And they're all loving the stuff. So whiskey is one of those drinks that really cuts across gender lines. So let's just understand that real quickly.
Yeah, that's,
before we go any further.
That's odd. My wife actually has started drinking whiskey as well.
Yeah, so is mine when she's not pregnant.
Yeah.
which is a good idea.
Which is awesome. She typically doesn't like the peatier whiskeys, but she does like more of the Highland type of whiskeys.
I've got a Pamela to the point where she will actually ask for a glass of Laphroaig every now and then.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So we all poured a little bit of a glass. Mark, why don't you tell us what you have?
Well, I have the classic Lagavulin 16 from Isla. And just full disclosure, Lagavulin is one of our sponsors on Whiskey Cast. But I would have picked that one even if they weren't a sponsor.
I would have too.
And who would blame you?
Yes, I don't think anybody would blame you. I'm actually having one of my favorites. It's a I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but it's definitely the most unique, I feel like, that I've had in quite a while. It's the Ardbeg Corey Vrekken. Am I saying that right, Mark? Is it Corey Vrekken?
Yeah, Corey Vrekken. That's fine.
Okay. It's very unique whiskey because at the end, it almost has this... the finish has this pepper sauce almost. That's very unique to Ardbeg, I think. I'm sure you've tried it. What are your thoughts, Mark?
Oh, it's been a few years since I've had Corey Vrekken, but if I remember well, I get that pepperiness, the classic Ardbeg peatiness, the little bit of creosote, a little bit of tar notes. But it has been a while since I've had that one.
Dave, what are you having?
I'm drinking the Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Mark, Laphroaig is basically our favorite, the Laphroaig 10.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I tried it, I hated it. And then a couple of years later, when I had a little bit more experience under my belt, I tried it again and couldn't figure out why I didn't fall in love with it the first time. But I'm
it is an acquired taste.
Yes, absolutely. And once you acquire it, you kind of lose the taste for a lot of other scotches. At least that's what happened to me. Not that I think they're bad, but I'm just underwhelmed by them often. But today I'm drinking the Quarter Cask, which is also really, really good.
So Mark, what I thought we would do is just kind of have almost a whiskey 101, and I thought you'd probably be the guy to have on to talk about this. You know a lot more about it than both Dave and I do. And so let's start out really quick with, what are your thoughts on the Copita nosing glass versus the Glencairn glass? Let's start with the vessel in which we are drinking the scotch from.
Well, I usually use Glencairns.
Okay.
I have Copitas at home, but I have a lot more Glencairns, and I prefer those just because they don't knock over. My cats can't knock them over when they get up on my desk, so that doesn't become a problem. And as far as I'm concerned, whatever glass you like is fine. I don't prefer rocks glasses because they let too much of the aroma escape, but if I'm just drinking for fun as opposed to doing a serious nosing, I don't mind a rocks glass with a cube of ice in it once in a while. I don't do it very often, but that's what I'll do occasionally. It's whatever glass you've got handy, as long as it's not a red sippy cup or something like that, or a red solo cup, I don't care what you drink it with.
Right.
If it's your whiskey, drink it the way you like it, for crying out loud.
That's what Dave and I have said before, is, you know, if you're a bourbon guy, great. You know, stick to bourbon. If you're an American whiskey guy, great. If you're a Scotch guy, great. You know, You're drinking to enjoy the whiskey.
Right. Obviously, any vessel made of glass is going to be superior to one made of plastic.
Definitely.
Because with the plastic, you're going to smell the plastic, and it's going to affect the taste of your whiskey. And, you know, we're kind of... our philosophy is that drinking whiskey is something... It's something that's done because it's refined, and it's something that's so good that, you know, you do it because of its goodness. That there is an innate... goodness to whiskey, and so you should do it in such a way that you maintain and preserve the goodness. So drinking out of a plastic cup, I mean, like, nobody's gonna sue you,
right?
But we reserve the right to judge you.
I don't judge anybody. I might roll my eyes, but I try not to judge.
Okay, okay, that's better said.
Okay, so let me ask you, Mark. Let me ask you, the first time that you ever had a whiskey, do you remember what it was? Do you remember what your thoughts were? What was your first experience with whiskey?
Well, other than the usual experience in college where you're drinking something cheap, a lot of it, and usually throwing it up within hours or the next morning, the sort of revelation for me that brought me to the whiskey world was 20 years ago this year. In Sarasota, Florida, I was down there taking care of my grandmother's estate, and I've told this story before, so if you've heard me interviewed someplace else, you may have heard this one, but there is a great little whiskey bar in Sarasota called Michael's on East, and back 20 years ago, they had a separate, what they called the tasting room, which was over near Sarasota General Hospital, and it's a storefront. And at the time, half of it was this little wine and dessert bar, and the other half was a retail liquor store. And they were connected in the middle with a passageway. And I was going in there a couple of nights a week while I was down in Florida for a while. And I'd go in, And one night they had a flight of single malts on special. And I was thinking at the time, you know, I'm getting to the point where I really ought to see if I like something besides beer and wine. So I thought, okay, let's give this a try. So I put my credit card down on the bar, told the bartender, okay, teach me what you know. Let's try this flight. He pours four single malts. I don't know what they were, but there was a Highland, a Lowland, a Speyside, and an Islay. And I immediately picked up on the differences between them and decided right then and there that I kind of liked Scotch whiskey.
All right. What an awesome story, because little did you know your whole life was about to change.
Exactly. And I walked across, because at the time I was living up in Alaska, and I said before I was down in Florida, so I had to fly back. I did not have room in my suitcase to haul bottles. So I went to the retail side. I bought a set of Balvenie miniatures. They had a three-pack of Balvenies for like 10 bucks or something like that. And so I bought that, took it back to Alaska, and I've been drinking whiskey ever since.
All right.
That's awesome.
And writing about it for the last 12 years.
So how long did it take to become, you know, to acquire at least some level of expertise? You know, I am not an expert at all in whiskey. I just kind of pretend to be one on the radio sometimes. but really, I've never actually claimed to be that or would ever insinuate. But how, I mean, were you doing more than just drinking whiskey because you liked it? You know, how did you become the Mark Gillespie that you are today?
Oh, brother. Well, one, I don't consider myself an expert either. There are people who know far more about it than I do. And I think to be an expert, you have to be able to make whiskey. And I can't do that.
Ah.
But there are people who know far more about it than I do. What I did, and the reason I started WhiskeyCast, was to further my own education and my own knowledge. Because what I was doing at the time before I started it was getting the ideas behind it and starting to learn more about it. But I figured as a journalist that I could really learn a lot about it by talking to the people who make the stuff and talking to the real experts. And that's why I started the show, was basically as my way of learning more about whiskey and being able to talk to these folks. And I figured there were obviously more people than me who wanted to learn about it. So I figured if I could share my journey with them, then we'd all benefit.
Okay.
And it just sort of got to the point where I sort of picked up a lot of knowledge about it and sort of kind of became what some people would call an expert. I don't want to use that term. I'd like to think I'm fairly well educated on whiskey, but there are still things I learn every time I try something new and every time I talk to someone new.
Well put.
Yeah, that is well put. Okay, so let me talk. So there's a lot of guys out there, like I mentioned to you, Mark, that are, you know, they're trying to get into, quote unquote, the whiskey game, you know, making that, you know, whiskey is a hobby. How do you refine your palate? How do you, like, be able to pick up on notes, you know, as far as when you're nosing, when you're trying it with the finish? How do you figure out, okay, this is what is being drawn out of the whiskey? How do you refine your palate?
Well, I was picking up the basics early on from that very first flight. I knew there were differences, and I was trying to pin them down. And here is where I give full credit to my wife, Christina, because she is an excellent cook and has this full cabinet full of spices and hits the produce section at the grocery store all the time for all sorts of herbs, has an herb garden out and back. And I started following her through the grocery store, through the produce section, and nosing a little bit of everything. And just sort of sniffing stuff, and it looked kind of weird at the time. But I started going through her spice rack and looking at the various spices and picking up those notes and sniffing them to sort of build those mental memories. And she's the one who really taught me how to nose, or gave me the ability I needed to put words and aromas together.
That is awesome. I would have never thought to just go to the grocery store and, let me see what this smells like. Let me see what this smells like. But
yeah,
that
because
is a great idea.
If you don't pay attention to, for instance, what scallions smell like or what cilantro smells like, if you only pick, say, cilantro and use it as a spice in cooking, but you never actually smell the stuff. A lot of whiskeys will have a cilantro or coriander-like aroma to them in some cases. Hmm. You can pick that spice out. Same thing with black pepper. I didn't know there was white pepper until I started writing about whiskeys and discovered white pepper. There are multiple different varieties of oranges. You can get different kinds of apple flavors, tart green apples or more luscious red apples that aren't quite as tart. And you just sort of pay attention and open up your mind and open up your nose and your palate, and you'll pick this stuff up. I mean, if I can do this, you can do it.
So, Mark, this is something I've wondered about, and I just feel like this is, you're the perfect person to ask. I am a purist, kind of in general, just with different stuff in my life. So, of course, when it comes to drinking whiskey, I tend to be the same way. So, when I see a blended scotch, to me, my gut reaction is, that's subpar. You know, oh, that's not as good as a single malt. I'm a purist, therefore, I prefer single malts. Is that...
dumb?
Yes. Yes, that's my question. Like, I don't know. It's like, am I being an idiot?
Yes,
okay.
You are.
I knew it this whole time.
If we were in the same room, I'd be giving you the dope slap upside the back of the head right now. Here's why. I love blended scotches and blended malts and single grains and blended grains. If you've ever had a good Compass Box Hedonism blended grain whiskey, they're amazing. If you've ever had a blended malt, a lot of the ones that Compass Box does are blended malts that are outstanding. There are five different types of scotch whiskey, and each one has its own unique characters. The way I've always characterized this is that I think of single malts as a jazz soloist, for instance. And a blend is more like a symphony playing a classical piece or a concerto, where all of the whiskeys that go into that blend are complementing each other and playing in unison. Not one of them isn't trying to stand out from the crowd like a jazz soloist might. They're trying to play together, and you can like classical music and you can like jazz. And that's the approach I take with it. It is a unique skill to create a blended whiskey and to be able to do it consistently over and over and over again with different casks from different distilleries, different distillery characters, and still be able to make it taste the same. The only thing that makes single malt special is that it's the product of a single distillery. Mm-hmm. And the only way you get the... differences in the distillery character are by age and by the different cask types. And when you get a blend together, you can pick out the different elements. You can hear the different instruments playing, just as you might in a symphony piece. But they all work together in harmony. And it's a richer, smoother experience than what might be a rough single malt. You're not going to get the smokiness in that Corey Vrekken or in the Laphroaig Quarter Cask. You're not going to get that in a blend, but what you're going to get is just this unique set of flavors and aromas that complement each other. And I think anybody that puts blended scotches down is selling themselves short and missing out on part of the experience.
Well, I'm really glad that you just confirmed that for me, because I've always suspected that secretly, deep down, I was a fool. And really what made me, I don't even know where I imbibed this attitude, you know, blended scotch. I don't think anybody's ever told me that. So I just kind of picked that up somewhere. But I was thinking about wine and how, you know, blended wines, I mean, that's, I don't know if it's just popular now, or I've just kind of just now noticed that it's popular, but you know, they've got these sommeliers that's their whole job, is they can blend wine to taste like anything. So it sounds like there are people who do the same for scotch.
Oh yeah. There are some very talented scotch whiskey blenders out there. And the other thing you have to remember is that even your single malts, your blessed single malts, almost always are blended together in one form or another. Unless it's a single cask single malt, it's been blended for age. It's been blended for different cask types.
Mm-hmm.
And just because the only difference is that it's using whiskeys from the same distillery. That 12-year-old single malt that you're drinking may well have 15, 18, a little bit of even older whiskey in it to give it the character that they're trying to create. The age only refers to the youngest whiskey in there.
Right.
Right.
So don't put blends down, because even your single malts, that Lafroy quarter cask you're drinking is blended. I guarantee it.
That's a that's great. That is
my whole life is a lie.
hey, Mark, let me ask you this.
David.
Yeah.
David, you're going to now do three Hail Marys, a couple of novenas, and
and things
go forth
better.
And sin no more.
There you go.
Yes, Father, I will.
Mark, let me ask you this. American whiskey has really jumped on the scene within the last couple of years. I know that they're even trying to get their own aisle in liquor stores, where it's not just a scotch, it's not just a bourbon, but it's an American whiskey. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in the American whiskey world, and is legislation going to pass that where they can have their own section?
Let's clarify this. Okay. As American single malt, we've had American whiskey for years. Bourbon is American whiskey. Mm-hmm. American whiskey is just this generic term for any whiskey that's made in America. It's more often used to refer to as stuff like Seagram's Seven Crown, or the really low-priced bottom shelf blends that actually have a lot more vodka and grain neutral spirits in them than they do whiskey, to be honest about it.
Really?
But what you're thinking of here is the American single malt category.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we now have is a lot of craft distillers that are making American single malt whiskeys. When you talk about the guys at Westland in Seattle, Stranahan's in Denver, Colorado, where I was last weekend, a lot of distillers, I think Balcones has us, and Texas has a single malt. There's probably 50 or 60 distilleries. St. George is in California. I'm going to forget something here. I'm going to get an email from somebody saying, you forgot about my distillery. I'm sorry, guys. There's a bunch of them out there making really good American single malts. And what you're talking about, it's not really legislation. It's more federal regulation.
Okay.
We've never had a specific category for single malt whiskey in America under federal regulations. So there's always been a sort of a problem when a distiller wants to refer to it as a single malt whiskey, unless it comes from Ireland, Canada, or Scotland. And here's the reason why. About 30 or so years ago, the last time we got serious about rewriting the standards of identity in federal regulations for alcohol and for various types of whiskey, those were the only three countries that were exporting whiskey in any serious amounts. So what the government did at that point was write the regulations so that if Canada said something was a Canadian whiskey under its laws, Scotland obviously said something was Scotch whiskey under its laws, and Ireland was an Irish whiskey under Irish law, then the U.S. would automatically accept that as a whiskey standard. And it didn't have to meet any other different standards. Whatever the Canadians, Irish, and the Scotch wanted to call whiskey was fine with the U.S. Nobody else in the world was really, at that point, the Japanese were making single malts, and there were a few other countries that were making them, but they weren't sending them to the U.S. So our government did not write any kind of a category for single malt whiskey into the same standards that we have for bourbon and rye whiskey. What we have is a straight malt whiskey category, which requires minimum 2 years of aging in new charred oak barrels, same like for bourbon. Well, single malt guys, distillers don't like to use new charred oak because they think it overwhelms the whiskey in a lot of cases. So what we've got now is this American Single Malt Commission that a bunch of the craft distillers have created that's lobbying the Tax and Trade Bureau within the Treasury Department, which is the agency that regulates alcoholic beverages, to create a single malt whiskey category that would allow for the same standards of identity that we have for bourbon and for other types of whiskeys and other types of spirits, frankly, but that would allow for the use of used barrels, that would allow for, right now, you can call something a malt whiskey in America. If it's an American single malt whiskey, you can call it an American malt whiskey and only have to put 51% malted barley into the grain, into the mash bill. you can make it with other grains because U.S. standard only requires 51%. The single malt guys want to say, okay, for it to be called a single malt, it should be 100% malted barley.
I see.
So that's what they're trying to get to.
Okay.
Now, they are pushing with the TTB. As we all know, there was a change in administration earlier this year, and that administration is decidedly anti-regulations of any shape and kind.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a hold in place on most new kinds of regulations. Now, the TTB has approved in the last few weeks and recent months new viticulture areas designating wine areas and wine regions, stuff that's been in the works for a while. So could this happen? It could, but it's not going to happen immediately, and they're going to have to prove to the government that this makes sense to do. So
yeah.
That's where we stand as far as an American single malt category.
That is interesting because it's not – I mean, you know, I guess technically it's a regulation, but it's more of a classification. You know, it's not so much the holding back as it is the allowance of, you know –
Well, it's the being able to actually call it a single malt whiskey,
right, right,
and
yeah.
not be undercut by those folks who say, "Well, ours is a straight malt whiskey, and they only made it with 51% malted barley."
Yeah, yeah,
and then they put corn into it or something like that.
I see.
So what they're trying to do is establish a high standard for what could be called an American single malt, so that they don't get undercut by people who are willing to cut corners.
So, Mark, speaking of new ways of doing things, one whiskey that we reviewed not too long ago is Cleveland whiskey.
Oh dear Lord.
I wanted to get your opinion on Cleveland whiskey. Like, what are
you... Or just not maybe not necessarily that distiller specifically.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's go there because okay. I have talked with Tom Licks, the guy who founded Cleveland whiskey, a couple of times, and when he got started, I slammed the initial release of Cleveland Bourbon. At the time, it was the lowest score I'd ever given a whiskey. I thought this thing just plain stunk.
Uh-huh.
And I told Tom after I posted the review, I ran into him at a conference a week later, and I said, "Tom, I'm going to be honest with you. I ripped the crap out of your whiskey, and here's why. I thought it was completely out of balance. There was nothing resembling any kind of complexity to it. It basically tasted like you took new make spirit and shoved it through wooden staves with a pressure cooker, which is essentially what he did.
Well, yep, that's about right.
Yeah. And he took it well, believe it or not.
Okay.
And he said, "I hope you'll come back. We're still refining this process. I hope you'll try it. Give us a try in a couple of years and see if we've changed." And so I said, "Okay, I'll be glad to do that." And a couple of years later, I was driving through Ohio. I stopped at the grocery store and looked in the liquor section, and they had a bottle of their Cleveland 87 bourbon, which was a newer version. And I went ahead and I paid for the bottle and took it home, tasted it, and said, "Okay, this is still not great whiskey, but it is significantly better." And posted the review for it. And told Tom when I ran into him at a conference a couple of years after that, I said, "Tom, I tasted the 87. You're right. It's better. It's still not great. It's not going to be a top shelf bourbon by any stretch of the imagination, but it's drinkable now." And then I tried what he's been working on. What he decided to do, and he still makes that other stuff, but what he's doing now is using his little pressure cooker doohickey with finishing woods. And using things like maple and cherry wood,
right,
and stuff like that, and creating a line and taking slightly more mature whiskey and using this to add a finishing touch to it. And I got to admit, I was impressed with those. I thought that was a better use of that technology than to try to create a bourbon, because my take on craft distilling and using the technology to create these Franken whiskeys was, if you can't even get it close to the quality of something from, say, an Elijah Craig or a Wild Turkey,
right,
or an Old Forester, if you can't even get it close to that quality, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
But with the finishing woods they're using, they're able to create something somewhat different. And it was a unique taste and works in cocktails. And I'm okay with that. I don't think that's a bad use of the technology. If they're taking slightly more mature whiskey and using it to add a finishing characteristic as opposed to trying to give it the look, feel, and something of the taste of a much older bourbon.
Yeah, so the one that we tried was the cherry wood.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, I thought it was okay.
I liked it better with ice on it than I did straight. It was actually the first time that I said on the show live, I said, I think I'd like this with ice. You know, that was the first time I said that reviewing a scotch. Yeah. Reviewing a whiskey, but...
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm also curious to see if... Is this just, you know, the technology just doesn't work as well as the aging process? Or, you know, is it just something that they haven't quite figured out yet?
Let's put it this way. The big boys and girls of the whiskey industry, the Diageos, the Pernod Ricards, the Brown-Formans, the Beams of the world, they've experimented with this stuff before.
Ah.
If they could actually have gotten it to work, they would have implemented it years ago.
Yeah.
They've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time trying to figure out ways to accelerate
the process,
the maturation of whiskey. Mm-hmm. And they've all settled on the fact that, no, aging it properly is what does the best.
That makes
if sense. They could do it, they'd get away with it.
Yep.
If they could do it, they'd do it in a heartbeat because they've got shareholders and the analysts and Wall Street to keep happy. So they'd do it if they could. But they don't because they realize that it doesn't work.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, Mark. Well, as a guy who I try to at least stay up with, mainly through actually your podcast, but I try to stay up with kind of what's going on in the whiskey world. It seems like that there are distilleries, especially in overseas across the pond, that are kind of coming back to life. If you will, you know, they're still in the process of, you know, they have to wait the first 2 years before they can even release anything. And hopefully they have enough patience and their shareholders will give them enough time to actually produce the right one. But what's one that's coming up, you know, that's maybe an up and coming distillery that we may not know about that is kind of on your radar?
Ooh, boy, there's a few of them. And it's one of these. I'm going to get an email. You forgot about my distillery.
Yeah, I'm setting you up with that. I'm sorry about that. That was not on purpose.
The one I tried this week that I mentioned on this week's podcast was the Cotswolds Distillery in England. An American guy, Daniel Zohr, decided to build a distillery several years ago, and he's been making gin to get through that 3-year initial waiting period. And I just tried his first single malt release that came out this fall, and I think that's a pretty good one. The English Whiskey Company has had some good stuff that they're now up around 10 years old. Wolfburn, which is way up in northern Scotland, the northernmost mainland Scottish distillery right now, is doing some good stuff. There are a bunch of young distilleries that are creating some very good product. And I hesitate to start naming them because, like I said, I'm going to forget somebody.
Right.
And they're going to yell at me. And I'm tired of getting yelled at.
I don't blame you.
So yeah. My gut feeling is that you're going to see a lot of these young distilleries that are going to try to release stuff at 3 to 4 to 5 years old. And it may not be as great as you'd like, but give them a couple more years and come back when they're 7 to 10 years old. And I think you're going to like their stuff.
I like that.
So I've run into people who appear to know a lot about drinking whiskey, and I've had many people who are experienced whiskey drinkers say, never put ice in your whiskey. And
okay.
Can you say what? First of all, why do they say that? And is that true?
Yes. Here's why. If you are drinking casually, I referred earlier to rocks glasses and occasionally putting an ice cube or two in. If you are drinking whiskey on a hot summer's day out in the backyard and you want to put an ice cube in, I got no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like ice in your whiskey and it's your whiskey, that's cool. Go for it. Here's why I don't put ice in my whiskey. When I'm evaluating whiskeys and doing serious nosing and tasting, remember how we all learned in science class that heat expands stuff and cold contracts it?
Yes.
Does the same thing with whiskey. when you warm up a whiskey by holding that Glencairn glass in your hand, it helps release aromas. Room temperature water, a few drops can help release aromas and breaks the chemical bonds that creates a chemical reaction in the whiskey that releases aromas and flavors. That's why you put just a few drops in. When you put ice in, the exact opposite happens. And it draws those flavors back in. It goes and sucks everything back in. So that's why I don't put ice in whiskey, for one reason, when I'm doing a serious nosing or tasting. The other reason I don't like to put ice in whiskey is, where do you get your ice from?
The fridge.
Tap water.
The fridge. The tap water and the fridge.
Right.
What else do you keep in that refrigerator?
Who knows?
All sorts of stuff.
All sorts of stuff like onions, garlic, fish. And unless you have, even if you have an ice maker, unless you have a dedicated standalone freezer that does nothing for, but make ice, the stuff that you keep in the refrigerator and the freezer, as the air circulates around in there, it's going to take those aromas, and the water, as it's freezing, picks up those aromas gently. So you're going to pick up, you might pick up a little fishiness if you've got frozen fish in the refrigerator, in your freezer, or if you've got garlic in the refrigerator. It picks up those aromas, and that aroma goes into the ice, which then goes into your whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to throw it off.
And Dave, as a purist, you would appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, I'm glad you. I was trying to ask that question in a neutral way without letting my bias show.
If you want to put ice in your whiskey and you bought the whiskey, that's fine. If you're at my house and I'm serving the whiskey, if you ask for ice, I'll give it to you, but I'll tell you why I don't like doing it.
Right.
This is exactly, Mark, that's exactly how I feel. You can put ice in your whiskey, but you're not putting ice in my whiskey.
Well, I don't say that to be a bad host. I'm just saying it because if somebody's used to having 2 ice cubes in their whiskey, okay, I'm not going to argue with it, but I'll tell you why. Here's why I don't do that.
Yeah.
And if you want to actually get all the aroma and all the flavor that a whiskey has to offer, that's why you don't put ice in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you still want to do it, okay, more power to you. I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to fight you over it. I won't kick you out of my house, but I'm not going to pour the good stuff.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I think I would just try to give you a hard time and suggest that, well, here, let me pour you a glass of Evan Williams.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, not to knock Evan Williams. It's just, you know.
Yeah. I hope you don't knock Evan Williams. I like Evan Williams.
Yeah.
And
well,
even
I,
if they
I
weren't
think
a sponsor, I like
Evan
Williams.
Evan
Williams. no, actually, if you look at the Evan Williams single barrels, those generally go $25-$30. That's one of the best underrated bargains in whiskey these days.
Really? I'll have to check which one I have.
That's interesting. I have to grab one because I haven't had one in a long time. Okay, I gotta ask you. We're running out of time here, and so I have 2 more questions. But this is one
sure.
I really want to ask is about Mr. Richard Patterson, aka
yes.
The Nose. Have you had a chance to meet him?
I thought you listened to the show.
Well, I'm a new listener. I've only been listening for like the last month.
I'm kidding.
Okay.
And Richard has been a regular on the show. And as a matter of fact, on our WhiskeyCast HD videos, I sat down with Richard a couple of years ago and did a 2-part video interview.
Okay.
That runs, the 2 parts together run almost half an hour or so.
Awesome. I'm going to have to.
Where we sat down at the Victoria Whiskey Festival a couple of years ago for an in-depth interview that. I broke into 2 segments. If you look on YouTube, you'll find it there. If you look under WhiskeyCast HD on YouTube, you can find it there and also at our website. But yeah, Richard's an old friend.
I've known
Richard
awesome.
For many years, and I have a lot of respect for him.
He is very interesting. The way he just goes about his nosings, and I mean just his tasting.
Is that
tasting.
The guy who like says,
nice to meet you,
and like throw it,
yeah,
throw it over his shoulder and pour another glass?
Yes. He's
Well, let's explain what he's doing here. What he likes to do is the first pour that he puts into a glass, he uses that first pour to clean it. So he swirls it around and cleans the lip off by tossing it out of the glass.
Right. But he's also funny.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got great comedic timing.
Yes.
Right.
But he's doing that to clean the glass out. So don't just think he's throwing away really old whiskey. And he does that with the old stuff, too.
Yeah, I know. I was kind of like scandalized the first time I saw him. What? Did he just pour that out? All right, Mark, I do have one last question. I almost hesitate to ask this question, but I just
go ahead.
I have to.
There are no dumb questions.
Do you have
there
a favorite?
There are no dumb questions.
Do you have a favorite?
That's a dumb one.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm kidding. I do not have a favorite. The website has my tasting notes for more than 2,000 different whiskeys. I have, I think, 8 of them that have scored 98 points, which means that I've never given out 100 or a 99 because I haven't found one yet that I would give those scores to, which means I'm still searching for a favorite. For me to give out a score of 100 for a whiskey would mean to me that that would be the only whiskey I would ever want to drink for the rest of my life. I haven't gotten there yet. So I'm still looking for my favorite whiskey. I mean, I haven't found it. I might someday. I've found some really, really good ones, a whole lot of really good ones, but I haven't found that ultimate whiskey yet.
This isn't my last.
I hope that answers.
Yeah, this is my last question, but I just want to piggyback off of that one. Do you typically lean more toward the Islays, the Speysides, the Highlands, the Lowlands? What do you typically lean towards? All of them.
All of them.
Yes, I like that. All of them. I like that.
Well, it's not just those. I lean towards bourbons. I lean towards Canadian whiskeys. I drink whiskeys. If you look at my shelf, you'll see whiskeys from all over the world. And I think that there are people all over the world making really, really good whiskey. And they deserve a lot of credit for it. And I'd like to give them some of that credit.
Yeah, Japan's another one that kind of
seems. Oh yeah,
Japan and India. India has the Amaroot. We've
the Fusion. Yeah,
we've had that one before, and I mean that's a really good one too. So
if you look at our website, I've been to the distillery several years ago. I went to the distillery in Bangalore, and we've got a video from there on the website as well.
I'm gonna have to this is gonna be a huge time suck for me because I'm gonna go onto your website.
Mark, you have an awesome job.
Yeah, you do have the best job, as you say on your show.
I love my job.
Yeah,
I love this job.
Okay, last question I have for you. As a guy who's just now getting into whiskey, wanting to get into it, the advice you would give them?
Okay, start slow. Do not start with the Lafroigs, Lagavulins, Ardbegs of the world, as we are doing tonight. This is a case of do as we say, not as we do. What I would do, if you're starting out with a whiskey for the first time, I have several that I recommend for, at least in the single malt category. There's two or three that I like to recommend to a newcomer, and I think there's a whiskey out there for everyone. And I have tried this with all sorts of people, and I can get them to like it. What I do is take something like a Highland Park 12-year-old. And once again, Highland Park is a sponsor. Let's get that out there. I believe in full disclosure and transparency. But I also do this with an Aberfeldy 12-year-old. Neither of those whiskeys have a lot of peatiness to them. And what I will do is water it down 1-to-1 for a new beginner to whiskey.
Okay.
1 ounce of whiskey, 1 ounce of water. 50-50 mix. That knocks it down, the alcohol volume down significantly. Remember, we're talking about 40% minimum alcohol here. A lot of folks who have been used to drinking beer or wine, the most they're ever going to have with wine is maybe 15% tops.
Sure.
So you want to bring them along slowly. What I do is start them out with 1-to-1 ratio, 1 ounce of whiskey, 1 ounce wine, or I'm sorry, 1 ounce whiskey, 1 ounce water, or half and half. And then gradually, as they get used to the taste and the flavor, the next drink you might add a little bit less water. And just sort of work your way up over time until you're drinking it with just a few drops of water. Don't try to drink it neat from the beginning, because you'll only get turned off by it. And if you drink an Islay, you're really going to get turned off by it, because a lot of people don't like that real heavy smokiness at first. Start with a Speyside, a Highland whiskey like a Highland Park 12, an Aberfeldy 12. There are a few others out there I would pick that you can start with that would be nice and simple single malts, or even a blend. And do those at 1-to-1 ratio, and then gradually start reducing the amount of water you put into a whiskey and increasing the amount of whiskey. And at that point, you're going to get used to it and bring yourself along slowly. Don't try to rush into this.
This is just like what happens to people with coffee. Nobody starts off drinking a black coffee. They always put, you know, putting sugar and creamer in it. And then a year later, they're just, you know, drinking the hard stuff. So this only makes sense that that would be your approach. I think that
I still drink my coffee with cream and sugar. So,
well, give it time.
I don't like black coffee. I'm sorry. It's too bitter for me.
Mark, that's not what it's about. You just end up doing it.
I believe it's also a sugar delivery vehicle as well as a caffeine delivery vehicle.
Maybe
we're missing
out.
Totally new philosophy. Yeah,
maybe we're missing out. Mark, I am very grateful. I have thoroughly enjoyed your podcast. I am a new listener, but I thoroughly enjoyed. I've been trying to catch up. You have a lot of podcasts on there. So
yeah, you have almost 700 episodes.
Yeah, so it's
well. If I can tell you, I've gotten emails. It's been a couple of years since I've gotten these emails, but most of them for some reason seemed to come from Sweden, where I would get somebody who discovered the show and then immediately went back and binge listened to all 400 or 500 episodes over 2 to 3 weeks over the holidays. And I'm going, I wish I had the time to do that because I don't have the time to go back and listen to 400 of my episodes. Where people would just sit there and listen from episode one. We still get downloads for episode one 12 years ago,
wow,
which was, I think,
awesome.
6-7 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
And people just binge listen through the entire 12 years of archives. And, hey, that's great. I love it. More power to you. If you've got that amount of time, I love it. That's what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah, that is awesome. So tell them how they can get a hold of you on social media. You're on Twitter quite a bit. What's your Twitter handle?
At WhiskeyCast with a T on the end and no E in whiskey. It's WHISKYCAST. And you'll find us at that handle on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. And at WhiskeyCast.com. We're also on iTunes with both the weekly show and our monthly WhiskeyCast tasting panel podcast and the WhiskeyCast HD video podcasts as well. That you can find through iTunes, or you can download all those from the website as well.
Well, Mark, I greatly appreciate it. We'll send you over a Catholic Mansion Glencairn glass. That way you can say that you have one. Not that you are running low on Glencairn glasses.
I appreciate it, guys. I'll drink from it gladly.
All right. Well, hey, thanks so much, Mark. We're very grateful.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've been listening to The Catholic Man Show with Adam Minhan and David Niles. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Cheers.
Cheers to Jesus.